Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Slate Money, a weekly podcast devoted to the world of business and finance. I'm Felix Salmon, senior editor at Fusion, and today we're going to be talking about Credit Suisse, the Swiss bank convicted of conspiring to help tax evasion. Does the first criminal conviction of a big bank make a dent in the argument that big banks are too big to jail? We'll talk about the case for reparations, the 14,000-word essay from Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic that is both more and less than an argument for writing checks to descendants of slaves. And then we'll talk about the $250,000 dinners that former Fed chairman Ben Bernanke has been having with investors. Is that business as usual? Is it corruption? Is it both? And finally, as ever, we will go around the table for a lightning round of interesting numbers. From this past week, I'm joined in our New York studio by Kathy O'Neill, a former hedge fund quant who's now a watchdog of the industry. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
And also Slate's Moneybox columnist and signed up true millennial, Jordan Weissman. Hello, Jordan.
Hello, Felix.
Hello. So, Jordan, you are going to start by telling us something about what Attorney General Eric Holder has been promising for weeks.
So this week, the big event happened. Eric Holder came out and announced that Credit Suisse, the Swiss bank, had pleaded guilty to helping Americans evade their taxes for decades. For decades and decades, we're talking secret accounts, cash in luggage being ferried around between the continents. And, of course, you know, people have been waiting and waiting for some bank to be convicted criminally for something. And so Eric Holder finally, who had previously suggested that maybe these mega banks were too big to jail in front of Congress and has been trying to walk it back ever since, got up in front of the American people and said no bank is too big or too important economically to face the law, you know, the consequences of their actions, you know, too big to jail.
So what are the consequences of a guilty plea to a criminal activity?
Almost nothing. It's, you know, it's amazing because in order to secure, or at least it's very little, let's put it that way. In order to secure this guilty plea, essentially what the Justice Department had to do was make sure that all of the worst potential consequences, repercussions that they might face wouldn't happen. They went and worked with regulators to say, we're not going to revoke, you know, the bank's
license.
You know, license its charter.
So this is the New York bank regulators had this rule that if a bank was ever found guilty of a criminal activity, then they would revoke that bank's license. And if you're not allowed to operate in New York, you basically have to shut down the entire bank because New York is a global banking center. So in order to get this guilty plea, they first had to go along to the New York regulators and say, you know what, even though they plead guilty, you're not going to shut them down, are you?
Well, you know, First of all, Credit Suisse is a very safe bank to start this new not-too-big-to-jail plan for Eric Holder. It's not very, very convincing to me, at least. It doesn't have a lot of banking business, a typical sort of depositor banking business in New York to begin with. So, you know, the risk wasn't very high to begin with. But
You mean the risk of a bank run in New York?
Yeah, that kind of – or even just the risk of on Credit Suisse for actually having penalties, which they're not having true penalties.
Well, they had to pay $2.6 billion.
Okay, they had a fine. They had a fine. So I just want to go back a little bit to the point of whether criminal charges is any different from a settlement. And I just want to make the point that from the perspective of this case, it doesn't look like it. But if we had a different case, it might have. So here's what I mean.
Give me an example.
Well, here's what criminal charges usually do. They usually set precedent. So if we found out that the bank was doing some kind of newfangled fraudulent thing, and then they were found criminally guilty of that, then it would have set precedent for that being really criminal and fraudulent. Now, unfortunately, this example isn't a very good example of that because it's like probably the oldest crime imaginable, which is helping people evade taxes. Probably the only older crime is like evading taxes.
But there are lots of American banks who have and will in future help people evade taxes. Is this not a sign to say Citigroup that if they're found guilty of this, then they too will actually be faced with criminal charges?
Well, that's when you go to the question of what are they actually, what are they facing in terms of punishment? And then what we see is a smallish fine, not a tiny fine, but, you know, certainly the people who actually disobeyed the law are not paying that fine. So that's important to remember. And then again, and we saw a whole lot of news this week about waivers and how even when there is something that banks are told they can't do any longer because they were found doing it wrong, then the SEC waives that and they actually can keep doing it. And Credit Suisse's CEO has been walking around saying that all their business partners are still happy to do business with them. There's not even a stigma attached to it.
It has to be said that in terms of the legal situation here, and we are getting down into the weeds, and I apologize for that on a Saturday morning. I know you don't want to be too gnarly, but the legal situation here is complicated by the fact that what the U.S. government wanted was for Credit Suisse to hand over the names of all of the Americans who hadn't been paying taxes. And Credit Suisse was absolutely correct in saying that it wasn't allowed to do that because that would be a violation of Swiss law, and they're a Swiss bank, and they literally couldn't. So they wound up pleading guilty to a crime which they kind of were forced to commit under Swiss law.
That may be true. I still think this sets a really bad example in a lot of ways, because when you look at the punishment they got, in the end, it was far lighter than what happened to Wegelin. It was another Swiss bank. It was
to who, sorry?
Wegelin. It was the oldest bank in Switzerland. And because they also got wrapped up in this whole tax evasion issue, and they faced indictment in the U.S., even though they didn't, I actually can't tell if they had much of a U.S. operation at all, other than helping them people evade taxes. But they ended up having to sell off most of their assets and shut down what was left of the bank. The oldest bank in Switzerland.
When was this?
This was, I am blanking on, it was a few years ago that they actually all shut down. But in the end, because this was a much smaller bank, they got raked over the coals by the Justice Department. By comparison, Credit Suisse, clearly its scale worked to its advantage. And that's not encouraging. And I mean, economically, you understand why they do that. You don't want to have like a self-inflicted Lehman, not that that necessarily would have happened. But it's still, it goes to show that there's advantages still to being very big when it comes to criminal justice.
Yeah, I certainly don't think that we've really seen the end of too big to jail. We've seen a different manifestation. It's like if you're big enough, you don't actually get in trouble. And moreover,
you
don't pay yourself.
I need to ask, what do you guys want? Jordan, are you saying that Credit Suisse should have been shut down? Kathy, are you saying that Credit Suisse should have been shut down? What if this isn't enough, what would be condign punishment?
I vacillate. Like I said, from an economic perspective, what happened to Credit Suisse, we're probably all better off that they weren't just shut down. I mean, I think that's pretty obvious. But, you know, I come from a perspective of it would be good maybe if these mega banks weren't so huge that they are actually above the law. But beyond that, if they are going to be this size, then there has to be some mechanism to go after or hold actual senior executives accountable. Or otherwise, they treat the fines as the cost of business.
Well, there were criminal
They were low-level bankers,
indictments against,
though,
like, 9 different Credit Suisse bankers.
But they were low-level bankers in Switzerland.
You know, so I'm going to agree that there's 2 answers to that question. One, given our system now, the answer is everyone involved, including the people in charge of the departments, should have been put in jail. And if we could go back and have a better system, we'd make these things less interconnected, less huge, and shut down banks when this kind of thing happens.
You know,
is true that Brady Dugan, the CEO of Credit Suisse, is one of the very few big bank CEOs to have basically kept his position through the financial crisis. He seems to be weirdly untouchable, and he's been a Credit Suisse executive, or admittedly mostly on the investment banking side rather than on the private banking side, which is where the criminal indictments happened. But there seems to be no call from shareholders or from regulators or for anyone for him to suffer any kind of personal repercussions from this. And I guess you two would both like to see him lose his job?
He was there while this was happening. You know, I mean, this was...
Yeah.
You know, he was the man in charge. And in the end, by helping people evade taxes, you're helping them steal from the U.S. taxpayer. It is the oldest crime in the book, like you said. If you're not going to face consequences for that, what are you going to face consequences for?
On which note, we will move on to a different type of consequences. Here we are, 3 white people reading The Atlantic, the whitest activity you can possibly imagine. The cover story is a 14,000-word essay by Ta-Nehisi Coates about reparations and the plight of Black America. Kathy, can you tell us what's going on here?
Well, it's a great essay. It's a long essay.
It is very long.
Get your tea or your coffee ready. Basically, he defines reparations for slavery as a conversation, which, you know, people automatically want to skip to the end and say who gets paid, how they're going to get paid. And we can talk about that, too. But I just want to make the point that he's not saying that. He's actually saying we have to have this conversation as a nation to stop pretending to be color neutral and colorblind and stop pretending that we don't need affirmative action. In fact, embedded in this essay is the best argument I see for affirmative action, which he doesn't spell out. And I want to just do it just a little bit, which is to say that what he shows is that policies and laws have been racist in the past and that they have long-term effects. And that these long-term effects will not go away by us just saying, okay, it's over now. We're not going to instill those policies anymore. We're going to have to do more than that. And the only obvious way of doing that is to have policies that are actually going the other direction.
And what he shows is that, the 3 of us are all white. We all benefit continuously, even today, from these policies which effectively impoverished millions of Black Americans, not just during the slavery era and not just during Jim Crow, but well into the 60s and 70s and really into the present day as well. These things are still ongoing to the tune of, you know, $30-40 billion a year. That is money which is not going to Black people and should be, and is going to white people instead.
Yeah, so what I thought was especially artful about this essay is that most arguments about reparations begin with slavery. And this essay does not begin with slavery. He begins it in mid-century Chicago. And he focuses it on policies like redlining and the way the federal government essentially denied mortgage loans to Black people and forced them into these shady kind of under-the-table deals where they were sort of buying houses and ended up having their property more or less taken from them once they paid for it, because of federal policy. Federal policy impoverished Black America, is his point. And it didn't stop in slavery. It didn't stop after Reconstruction. You know, it kept on going until at least the late 60s.
So what Ta-Nehisi is calling for, when he is, Kathy, as you say, the cover line of The Atlantic is a little bit of a bait and switch. It's saying the case for reparations, but it's not really the case for reparations. What he's saying is that he wants a kind of truth and reconciliation process. He just wants us to be talking more about this and more about what can and should be done. What do you think?
I think we could go beyond the conversation. I'm just saying we have to start with the conversation.
But since this is a Slate Money podcast, is there something financial which can and should be done to sort of make up for this very shameful American history?
Well, first of all, I just want to make the point that if you read the Podesta report on big data a couple weeks ago that Obama commissioned, you'll see that it's still happening. Actually, in this essay, Coates talks about redlining, which is, you know, when the mortgages were denied to African-American families through the 30s, 40s, that the New Deal bypassed them. And it finally ended in 1968 with the Fair Housing Act, but it didn't really end. That's the point. And what we saw in the financial crisis, we saw reverse redlining, which is similar to what he describes there. What reverse redlining means is, yes, you can have a loan if you're an African American, but you're going to have to pay more than you should based on your credit history. And with going back to the Podesta report, what they said is that there's no reason to think that's not happening right now with big data models, that there's a discriminatory effect going on. So even before we start talking about how to fix stuff that happened in the past, let's talk about what's actually happening right now as a continuation of that.
I think that that's very true. And what's frustrating is that the types of graft that go on get more subtle and kind of insidious and harder to spot. A lot of what we found out about the housing crisis and that kind of reverse redlining came to light because of lawsuits where they just got to dig into these companies' files and it would be almost impossible to know without the power of subpoenas. And so it kind of goes further and further underground, but it's still there.
Actually, it's not completely
true. Hang on a sec. But this makes it easy in a way. Mm-hmm. We can all agree that things should be fair, and we can all agree that, you know, discrimination shouldn't happen in the present. But the point about reparations is that we need more than just no discrimination in the present, hard/impossible though that is. We actually also need to make up for the sins of the past. And so the question which I have for you is not, you know, are there things which we can do in the present to make things more fair in the present, but are there things which we can do in the present to make reparation for the sins of the past?
Okay, well, I agree. We should go past the, you know, making things fair.
So give me an example.
Let's start with making things fair.
Okay.
So, yes.
Neither you nor Ta-Nehisi actually wants to come out and give an example.
No, I do want to give
done.
An example. Actually, okay. Let's. If you want me to go there, Piketty's wealth tax. That's a source of money, and is a direct line into the results of slavery and then Jim Crow and then where did the wealth accumulate in white households?
And one of the pernicious effects of this institutionalized racism, which was in effect in the United States for well over a century, is that black families at every single point on the income scale have much, much less wealth than white families. And so, yes, a wealth tax would disproportionately affect whites and conversely benefit blacks. That would be one way of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the difficulty in saying what should we do is that when you actually start trying to put a fair number on what was slavery worth, for instance, you get into some incredibly high figures. I mean, there have been some academic attempts to quantify what slaves' labor, you know, was valued at, and if you added 4 or 5% interest per year, for instance, or versions of that exercise, and you start getting into the many trillions of dollars.
Well, Coates makes the point in his essay that the value of the slaves in America was actually greater than the value of the cotton or the value of the land.
Absolutely,
and it was massive.
And so that's why I think it's difficult to have this conversation, because off the bat, in a fantasy world, you could say, okay, we're going to do $1 trillion over 10 years or something in cash payments. I mean, and you do see proposals like that coming out of academia once in a while. And you see that number, and at that point, you start to say to yourself, what else would we be sacrificing in terms of a liberal project if you wanted to do that? I do think that
What would we be sacrificing? Wouldn't we have a lovely fiscal stimulus?
Well, that is actually one of the funny parts in the essay is during Reconstruction, there was a Southern senator who wanted reparations for blacks because he thought it would be stimulus for the South that had been so demolished during the war. In the academic literature now, people do bring up the fact that giving cash payments could, in the end, enrich everybody because it would be a stimulus. I do think that there's some academics at Duke, for instance, who talk about the portfolio approach, quote unquote, which is, no, we're not, reparations aren't going to be money that we're going to hand out, but it's going to be job training. It's going to be things like, you know, discounts on mortgages, whatnot, just sort of a variety of ways to try and right the wrongs of the past. And I think that if you were to ever somehow get the American people to a point where they could accept the idea of reparations, and right now the polling on it is on even giving an apology to black Americans for slavery, an official apology, I think it's a third of whites are even want that. We're saying literally for Congress to say we are sorry about slavery. Yeah. So getting to the point where we can actually talk about real reparations, when Ta-Nehisi says we need truth and reconciliation as a first step, he really, really means it.
Yes.
I mean, we're so far away.
I do want to have the conversation. I just want to add one more thing in terms of what we should actually be doing is once we have that conversation, we should be ending the war on drugs because that, if you've read the new Jim Crow, is a large part of the present day manifestation of these kinds of things we're talking about.
So we're not going to be writing large checks anytime soon, which means it's not necessarily a...
But who is getting a large check?
But who is getting a large check?
Oh, God.
Oh, the Jordan Weissman, the Segway king.
Seriously.
the man who is getting a large check, from not from the government, but from Wall Street, is Mr. Ben S. Bernanke, the former... chairman of the New York Fed. He has been on the road having dinner with a bunch of hedge funders and Wall Street types. And at the end of the dinner, he doesn't split the check. He doesn't pick up the check. In fact, he receives a check for $250,000. Kathy, this doesn't smell particularly tasteful, does it?
It really doesn't. And, you know, I know I'm going to sound old-fashioned, but we're not asking enough from our public servants if we allow this kind of thing to happen without any question. And I know you're going to tell me, Jordan, that like, oh, who wouldn't take a $250,000 check? But I just want to say, for the record, I have more sympathy for Clinton accepting a blowjob under his desk than I have for this guy, because the truth is, like, we all have our own vision of who we are to ourselves. And when Bernanke takes that money, he is selling himself.
Jordan?
I mean, I'm not going to, insofar as any government official is selling themselves after they leave public office. Yeah, I mean, yes, Bernanke is selling an appearance. To me, it's almost the same as, you know, the speaker circuit where a former president gets, you know, six figures to show, or not even a former president, but former generals, whatnot, get six figures to show up and talk to a company. And, you know, it's
different from that, because this isn't just about, look at this famous person who we've got to speak to us. The reason why these hedge funders are going to these dinners is because they think they can make money off it.
Well,
they can get some kind of inside information, and they want to know what Ben Bernanke is thinking, because they are rightfully convinced that the Fed policies right now are basically exactly Ben Bernanke's policies.
I think you're right that there is some difference there. I think that's going to fade pretty quickly.
Which is why he's doing so many of these dinners right now.
Also, you know, what strikes me about this, honestly, is what the reports are coming out that Ben Bernanke is saying to them, you know, that essentially rates are going to stay low for a long time, guys. Might not go up for my lifetime, whatever, you know, which is essentially Ben Bernanke sitting there saying, yeah, you know, I got a feeling about what might come up in the next 20 years. I mean, this does not sound like he is spouting gold here. You could pretty much, if you are not locked into a sort of 1970s mindset, as a lot of guys on Wall Street are about inflation and such, you can pretty much tell from everything Janet Yellen has said publicly that rates are not going to go up anytime that soon. And so unless, like, there's a lot that he's saying that isn't being reported, that hasn't leaked out, and he really is giving inside information that is confidential and he's not, like, legally not supposed to be sharing, it seems like the actual content of these talks is not particularly harmful. The optics are not...
Well, no one's saying it's harmful.
Or is not exactly that valuable.
I think it's relatively harmful.
Who's being harmed, Kathy?
Not that valuable, let me rephrase.
Me? The trust of the people in this country. You know, I just want to make the backup for one second and just look at who this guy is. He's a Princeton professor with a Nobel Prize. Am I correct?
He doesn't have a Nobel Prize, but he is a Princeton professor.
Okay, oops. he's an economics professor at Princeton. He's making easily $300,000 a year. He made $200,000 a year at the Fed. Like, the guy isn't, like, taking a vow of poverty by refusing to do these kinds of gigs. I'm just like, we're not asking too much for him to not give inside information to hedge funds and banks right after he leaves the Fed. It's something that it's not a law. I get that. But for his own self regard, why doesn't he understand what this looks like to the rest of us?
Well, I'm going to try to mount some kind of a defense of Bernanke here. I think the Jordan Weissman defense of there's not much value to these things is a weak defense, but it's true as far as it goes, that if you look at the public speeches of Ben Bernanke when he was Fed chair, of Janet Yellen now, of Mark Carney as head of the Bank of England, you know, you can get probably more value out of reading those public speeches than you can about having a private dinner. That said, there's a long tradition of the Fed chair meeting with Wall Street bankers. And one of the things that you find when you read Tim Geithner's book, because we can't possibly finish one of these podcasts without mentioning Tim Geithner's book,
true,
is that he would invite Ben Bernanke up to the New York Fed for dinner with a bunch of Wall Street titans, CEOs, hedge fund managers, that kind of thing. And they would mingle and talk and have discussions off the record. And certainly no journalists are ever invited to these things. And this happens as a matter of course with the sitting Fed chair for free. If you're going to be doing that kind of thing for free with Wall Street when you are the sitting Fed chair, at that point you start wondering, well, what's the harm in just continuing that tradition, but this time getting paid for it?
That's a defense. That's a really, really poor defense. I want to throw in that, you know, one of the things that bothers me about the $250,000 is that I can't personally afford that. But I do think as an occupier, as a taxpayer, I should be able to also have access to Ben Bernanke. What are the chances he's going to say, yeah, I'll come and talk to you guys? Like, he's an academic. I'm an academic. We don't charge for our time.
You know what? We'll put the ask out. I'll send him an email.
Awesome.
And I'll ask him to come on to Slate Money and see if we can have a dinner with him, or maybe not a dinner, maybe just sit him around this table for the podcast. And we, you know, for no money at all. We'll see
and just
what he says.
Tell him to prove that he can still do that kind of thing for free.
I guess the one point I would add on to this is I think it goes to show the degree to which people outside of government often overestimate the value of the opinions of people who have recently left government. Because it's not just Ben Bernanke. You see this in the lobbying world too. You know, people leave Congress, they leave the executive branch, and the private sector swarms and goes, oh, they must have all this information. It turns out they often don't.
Well, can I make another point, though?
Yeah.
It's not just the information they have now, but the fact that they might very well go back into government.
And I think that is a very fair point. And one of the reasons why I don't have the kind of revulsion to – and perhaps I should have the revulsion, but towards what Bernanke is doing is my sense is he's not heading back into government, that he's probably not going to be back anytime soon. Maybe I'm, you know, maybe that's not true.
We didn't think Larry Summers was going to come back, but he did.
That's the return.
And he might again.
And
again.
The current Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew, is a prime example of someone who just revolves back and forth between the public sector and the private sector. And it's absolutely clear that one of the reasons he is so well paid in the private sector is because he manages to get these very powerful jobs in the public sector.
Yeah, in fact, he got a huge amount of money to do that, leaving Citigroup to go into Treasury in his contract. So he actually had an incentive to grab that job.
And I think that is – there's sort of a bright line there, right, where you actually have somebody who is working at a corporation that says, please, for love of God, go get more power and access and influence, where it's obvious that the reason they want him to is so that he can come back at some point. Again, that when I look at these dinners and Bernanke is saying these sort of anodyne things about, you know, where interest rates may be heading – it doesn't strike me as quite the same, but I guess you're talking about a spectrum and also the potential for a slippery slope. And as you know, Lou shows, it can be very, very, very slippery.
Which brings us to our numbers. We all have numbers this week. I am going to start off because why not? My numbers is 3.6 million. And it's not really a particularly interesting number on its own. It's more of a plug. The number is the number of dollars that was raised in investment capital by one of the sillier dot-coms out there called Washio, which is one of these. There are dozens of them, these startups started up by one or two dudes who have just left college and realize that there's this thing called laundry, which is a pain. And so they're like, you know, we're going to set up a we'll do your laundry for you.com. And everyone seems to have the same idea. And they're all guys in their 20s. And it's all I can say is pick up a copy of New York Magazine, go to nymag.com and read Jessica Pressler's story about these laundry dudes. It is one of the best things ever written about the latest dot-com bubble. And you will find the $3.6 million number in there, but you will also find lots and lots of just awesome observation, so go read the article.
Oh my God. It reminds me of, I was in line for getting a coffee with a friend of mine, and he was having trouble with his disorganized wallet, and he was like, isn't there a startup that can solve this problem for me?
So like the Costanza problem, like the fat wallet.
Every nuisance needs to have a huge amount of funding for it. Yeah. My number is 43. So there was an NPR survey, which came out this week, which attempted to survey the 50 states and the District of Columbia to understand the extent to which defendants are charged for various things. And it turns out in 43 states, defendants can be billed for their free public defender. It's also true that they could be charged for things like room and board. I think that's 44 states. And I think in every state, and possibly the District of Columbia, you can also be charged for that electronic bracelet if you have to carry that around and go home with it.
Well, that's wildly depressing. My number is 300,000, which is how much apparently Macklemore, the rapper, charges to play a college campus. A third-party booking agency or someone from it leaked a huge list of what these artists charge to play. And while pouring through it, so I know something especially devastating, which is that Macklemore makes about $150,000 more per performance than Kendrick Lamar, who, as we all know, also was robbed of the Grammy for Best Rap Album this year by Macklemore. So just, I guess, you know, in art and commerce, just nothing is fair. Nothing at all.
And on the subject of fees, I will add one more number, which is a fake number. Macklemore gets $300,000 per appearance. Ben Bernanke gets $250,000 per appearance. There is a man you might have heard of if you were watching the movies last year called Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street, as was.
Oh, my God, yes.
And Jordan Belfort is on a speaking tour right now, and he owes the people that he ripped off about $50 million. And he claims that this speaking tour is going to make him $100 million this year, and that's going to allow him to repay his the people that he owes. And all I can say is, no way. It is completely impossible that he is going to earn anything like $100 million. And, of course, you should not go and see him speak. But also, if you needed any more proof that Jordan Belfort remains a sleazy liar, this is that proof. Even Macklemore couldn't make that kind of money.
Has anybody done the math on what it would actually take to accomplish that? Like, you know, you see those Santa maps, like
actually,
how long it would take.
I actually did the math, and I talked to Wes Neff, who's a speaking agent, and a couple of people I know who make real money on the speaking circuit. It basically just can't be done.
Okay.
We will leave it there on that wolfish note. You can write to us with your comments and your complaints and your ideas.
And your love.
And your love.
Especially your
love. Lots of compliments, please. We thrive on those. SlateMoney@slate.com. And people, please subscribe to Slate Money in iTunes or any podcasting app of your choice. Leave us a rating in the iTunes store. That's one of the best ways to help other people discover how awesome this show really is. Just search for Slate Money in the iTunes store and give us ideally a high rating. Would be nice. Or any rating if you must. The producers for Slate Money are Stan Alcorn and Tracy Samuelson. The executive producer of all of Slate's podcasts is Andy Bowers. You should listen to all of them, not just this one. For Kathy O'Neill and Jordan Weissman, I'm Felix Salmon. We'll talk to you again next week on Slate Money.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.